Well, hello everyone. I'm always reading, as people know, and recently I read for the first time one of the best books that I've ever read. It was called Democratic Ideals and Reality by Halford Mackinder, also known as the father of geopolitics. Now, I'm going to tell you, this book is worth reading as a work of literature. I really like the language and his kind of style and so on. It's just a really interesting book. And to demonstrate that, I'm going to read a passage from it towards the end of the video. But it has a great deal to say about the current situation and indeed about history from when he wrote this book, 1919, just after World War One. I think it was written on the occasion of the Versailles Treaty, where he was warning the Western powers to learn from history. And, you know, essentially, during the course of this book, he predicts Hitler, he predicts World War II, he predicts the coming of a kind of global hegemon, and he predicts, among other things, the current situation that we have now, where so much focus is on a certain country in Eastern Europe, namely Ukraine. So we'll talk more about that in a moment. Now, if you don't know Mackinder, his big idea, his big contribution, and he basically invented the field of geopolitics, is this idea here. You've got the world island, which is essentially the continent of Europe and the continent of Asia. The northern coast of Africa is included as well. And then all of the rest of the world are called the periphery islands. And then the world island is divided in two, the Rimland, which is all of the coastal area, including most of Western Europe and India, China, you know, the Arabian Peninsula and so on. And then you've got the heartland, which is centered in and around Russia and surrounding countries, including Eastern Europe. And this formula is pretty simple. Who rules East Europe commands the heartland. Who rules the heartland commands the world island. Who rules the world island commands the world. Now, pretty simple start, but what he basically does is he retells all of history, all of human history, from the point of view of how geography and how geographical features have actually led to this situation where various powers expand to their natural limits, depending on whether they are a sea power or a land power. And he argues that a lot of the Western powers in history were actually sea powers. He argues convincingly that the Romans, even though they look like a land power, actually they control the Mediterranean, and most of their power was based on controlling, closing the Mediterranean. Okay, obviously the British, he was writing as part of the British Empire, as a representative of it, were a big sea power in history. But then he looks at the land powers. And in fact, the two central chapters in the book are called The Point of View of the Seaman and The Point of View of the Landsman. A really interesting way of looking at history. Now, one of the things that I kind of came up with this map where he outlines these four central countries in Europe: Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Hungary. I think he also talks about Romania as well, as one of these crucial heartland countries in Eastern Europe. When he says who controls Eastern Europe controls the heartland, who controls the world, he's talking about this region here. And much of what he discusses basically justifies the creation of what we call today the Visegrad Group, which is basically an independent buffer zone between Western Europe, or between what we call the collective West, and Russia. And he argues that it's really important for those countries in the middle there to be have relative independence, sovereignty, in order to fend off the hordes coming from the east. I've depicted them as orcs there. That's not me having a go at Russians. That is just like, if you read Mackinder, this is how he always depicts these people coming out of the steppes, you know, these kind of hordes from the plains, you know. And so this was really influential, actually, on Hitler. Here's Hitler studying a map, and Mackinder informed his strategy during World War II, where he quickly moved to capture the heartland in his battle against the Russians. This was, of course, hindered by the fact that he had to fight a war on the Western Front as well, against the French and the British, of course, and later the Americans. But that was basically Hitler's idea, is that he was looking to capture the heartland in his push against the Russians. And then during the Cold War, the Russians took that territory back. Thank you, Churchill. Churchill basically gave the Western powers agreed to split those up with Stalin. So it looked like that during the Cold War. And then pivotally, for us now, after the Cold War, there was the NATO expansion, which has so annoyed a certain Vladimir Putin. And one of the avid readers of Mackinder is said to be Alexander Dugin, who is, you know, thought to be influential, you know, in Putin's Russia. How influential he is remains a matter for debate. A lot of people who in the know have said that that is overstated. But he wrote a book called, I think it's called something like Foundations of Geopolitics 2. And he was arguing this, the whole Euro-Asian Dugin strategy is all about heartland theory, which is why Putin is so focused on these countries in Eastern Europe, Belarus, Ukraine, and obviously he's got his eye on the others too. It is also why this has become the crunch issue of our time. You know, not only the Visegrad group, but the entrenchment of the European elites behind them and as against the Russians. And the Americans over on, if you remember, if you had a look at the way he thinks about the world, over on their periphery islands there, the Americans are kind of, well, they're a bit more ambivalent, kind of lost interest, as they often do when it comes to these things. And it seems like with Trump, there's a pivot happening here. I am sure the Europeans, if they're still thinking of Mackinder, are worried about this development, because if the heartlands fall under Russia's control, then Russia de facto then becomes, well, what was the formula? Who controls the world island commands the world. So pretty important. Now, just before I get into the second part of this video, where I'm going to read from Mackinder to give you a flavor of his language, his descriptions of the geography. I mean, I really love this book. It's so, I don't know, there's something about the people who are writing at this time, the kind of matter-of-fact nature of it that really appeals to me. Let me just urge you to buy courses from the academic agency. What shall I play today? How about Foundations of Logic? That's one I haven't played for a while. Yeah, that is part of the Trivium. There's also Foundations of Shakespeare and loads of other great courses. Buy them today. And when I come back, I'm going to be reading about 10 pages or so of this fantastic book by Halford Mackinder.
Now available at the Academic Agency. Sharpen your analytical mind and your argumentation skills with Foundations of Logic. The course draws on the ancient wisdom of traditional logic that students learned for over 2,000 years, from the time of Aristotle through to the medieval schoolmen, right down to the 20th century. Sign up now for a free preview lecture.
Be sure to like this video and subscribe. All right, folks, so we're back. Let us now read. This was one of my favorite passages. This is from the landsman's point of view, and it's often struck me when I've been reading, you know, civilizational history, world history, how often these men, these hordes, come from the deserts, from the plains, from the steppes. You know, they burst out and suddenly, like, conquer everybody. I've always been fascinated by that. And this passage talks about this, but it's also a nice passage to show how geography and the shape of the land and where the mountains are and where the forests are always key to Mackinder's consideration of what actually happens in history. So I'll just start from halfway down the page. Once more came the opportunity of the camel men, inspired by the preaching of Muhammad. The Arabs of the central oasis of Nejd and of its western extension in the Hejaz of Mecca and Medina set forth the Saracen armies who drove the Parthians from Mesopotamia and the Romans from Syria and Egypt and established a chain of inland capitals, Cairo, Damascus, and Baghdad, in the ancient trackway of fertility. Beautiful language. From this fertile base, the Saracen power was carried into all the regions around in such manner as to make a bid for a truly world empire. Northeastward, the Mohammedans ascended from Baghdad into Iran by the same passway which had guided the Parthians and Persians downward, and they spread even into northern India. Southward, they crossed from the Yemen headland of Arabia to the African coast south of the Sahara and penetrated on their camels and horses through the whole breadth of the Sudan. Thus, like a vast eagle, their empire of land power spread its wings from the Arabian centerland on the one hand over the northern heartland far into the depths of Asia, and on the other hand over the southern heartland equally far into the depths of Africa. But the Saracens were not content with a dominion based only on the means of mobility proper to their steppes and deserts. Like their predecessors, the Phoenicians and Shebans, they took to the sea. Westward, they travelled along the north coast of Africa, both on sea and land, until they came to two countries, Barbary and Spain, whose broad tablelands, neither utterly sterile like the Sahara, nor yet forested like most of the European peninsula, repeated in some degree the conditions of their homeland. On the other hand, eastward from Yemen at the mouth of the Red Sea and from Oman at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, they sailed on the summer monsoon to the Malabar coast of India, even to the fair Malay Islands, and returned home on the winter monsoon. Thus, the Arab dhows sketched out a sea empire extended from the Straits of Gibraltar to the Straits of Malacca, from the Atlantic Gate to the Pacific Gate. This vast Saracen design of northward and southward dominion of camel men, crossed by a westward and eastward dominion of shipmen, was vitiated by one fatal defect. It lacked in its Arabian base the necessary manpower to make it good. But no student of the realities about which must turn the strategical thought of any government aspiring to world power can afford to lose sight of the warning thus given by history. The Saracen Empire was overthrown, not from Europe or the Indies, but from the heartland in the north. A significant fact. Arabia is a sea girt and or desert girt in every other direction but towards the heartland. The western sea power of the Arabs was no doubt countered from Venice and Genoa, and their eastern sea power was subdued by the Portuguese after they had rounded the Cape of Good Hope. But the downfall of the Saracens in Arabia itself was due to Turkish land power. We must give some further considerations to the characteristics of the great northern heartland, and in the first place to those of the long grassy zone, which, south of the forest zone, extends across its whole breadth, overlapping westward and eastward, some distance into the adjoining parts of the two coastlands. The steppes begin in the centre of Europe, where the Hungarian plain is completely surrounded by a ring of forested mountains, the Eastern Alps and the Carpathians. Today, fields of wheat and maize have in large part replaced the native grass, but 100 years ago, before the railways had brought market within reach, the sea-like levels of Hungary, east of the Danube, were a prairie land, and the wealth of the Hungarians was almost exclusively in horses and cattle. Beyond the forested barrier of the Carpathians begin the steppes of the main belt, spreading eastwards with the shore of the Black Sea to the south and the edge of the Russian forest to the north. The forest edge crosses the Russian plain sinuously, but in a generally oblique direction, from the northern end of the Carpathians in the 50th parallel of latitude to the foot of the Ural Range in the 56th parallel. Moscow stands a short way within the forest, where there are broad clearings which constituted all of inhabited Russia until the recent colonization of the steppe southward. As far as the Volga and the Don, the wheat fields have now in large measure replaced the steppe grass. But until 100 years ago, the Cossack outposts of Russia were still based on the Dnieper and Don rivers, the trees along whose banks alone broke the vast levels of waving grass or of snow. The forest which clothe the end of the Ural Mountains form a promontory southward into the open steppes. Again, I love the language, the forests which clothe the end. It's just, I love his geographic descriptions. They're just brilliant, sweeping geographic and historical kind of coverage. Something about this book I really love. But the grass is continuous through the grassway of plain, which leads from Europe into Asia between the Ural Sea and the northern end of the Caspian Sea. Beyond this gateway, the steppes expand again to even greater breadth than in Europe. To the north of them are still the forests, but to the south are now the deserts and sub-arid steppes of Turkestan. The Trans-Siberian Railway traverses the grassy zone from Chelyabinsk, the station at the east foot of the Ural Mountains, where the lines are from Petrograd and Moscow unite, to Irkutsk on the Angara River, just below its exit from Lake Baikal. Wheat fields are beginning in large measure to replace the grass along the line of the railway, but the thread of settled population is still a narrow one, and the Tatar and Kyrgyz horsemen are still nomad over wide areas. The edge of the forest bends southward along the boundary between Western and Eastern Siberia, for Eastern Siberia is filled with forested mountains and hills, which fall in elevation gradually from Transbaikalian Plateau into the northeastern promontory of Asia towards the Bering Strait. The grassy zone bends south with the forest and continues eastward over the lower level of the Mongolian uplands. The slope upward from the great lowland into Mongolia is through the dry strait of Dzungaria between the Tainzian Mountains on the south and the Altai Mountains on the north. Beyond Dzungaria, the steppes, now at upland level, continue round the southern edge of the forested Altai and the Transbaikalian Mountains, with the Gobi Desert to the south of them, until they reach the upper tributaries of the Amur River. There is a forest belt along the eastern outward face of the Kingian Range, by which the Mongolian upland drops to the lowland of Manchuria, but is at last attached grassland in Manchuria to be, or Manchuria, is it, to be compared with the similarly detached grassland of Hungary, 5,000 miles away at the west end of the steppe belt. Grassy Manchuria does not, however, extend through to the Pacific shore, for there is a coast range of mountains thickly forested, inframes the open country and deflects the eastward flowing Amur to the northward mouth. Let us clear this long ribbon of steppes of its modern railways and cornfields, and people it again in imagination with horse-riding Tartars, who are none other than the Turks. It is said that the Turkish language of Constantinople can to this day be understood by the Arctic tribe at the mouth of the Lena River. For some recurrent reason, it may have been owing to spells of droughty years, these Tartar mobile hordes have from time to time in the course of history gathered their whole strength together and fallen like a devastating avalanche upon the settled agricultural peoples either of China or Europe. In the West, we hear of them first as the Huns, who in the middle of the 5th century, after Christ rode into Hungary under a great but terrible leader, Attila. From Hungary, they raided in three directions, northwestward, westward, and southwestward. Northwestward, they caused so much commotion among the Germans that those tribes nearest the sea, the Angles and the Saxons, were in part driven over the water to a new home in the island of Britain. Westward, they penetrated far into Gaul, but they were defeated in the great battle of the Chalons, where the Frank, the Goth, and the Roman provincial, standing shoulder to shoulder against the common enemy from the east, began that fusion from which has sprung the modern French people. Southwestward, Attila advanced as far as Milan, destroying on the way the important Roman cities of Aquileia and Padua, whose inhabitants fled to the lagoons by the sea and were found and there founded Venice. At Milan, Attila was met by Bishop Leo of Rome, and for whatever reason went no farther, with the result that the Roman see won a great prestige. Thus can it be said that with much truth that from the reaction of the coastmen against this hammer blow from the heartland, there arose the English and French nationalities, the sea power of Venice, and the supreme medieval institution of the papacy. Who shall say what great, and let us hope, beneficent things may not grow out of the reaction which has been compelled by the hammer blow of our modern Huns? The Hunnish raids ceased after many years, for it is probable that the manpower behind them was not very considerable. The force of a blow may be due as much to its speed as to its weight, but some Hunnish remains probably lingered in the grassy vacancy of the Hungarian plain, to be absorbed by new tribes of horsemen advancing westward, the Avars, against whom Charlemagne made war, and presently the Magyars. In the year 1000, these Magyar Turks, who had done much ravaging in Germany during the previous century, were converted to Christianity from Rome, and became thenceforth some sort of bulwark to Latin Christendom, so that no more Tartars were admitted into Hungary. But the economic life of the Magyars continued in the main to be that of the steppes until less than 100 years ago. When we reflect that through several centuries of the Dark Ages, the Norse pagans in their ships were at piracy on the northern seas, and the Saracen and Moorish infidels in their ships at piracy on the Mediterranean, and that the horse-riding Turks from Asia raided thus into the very heart of the Christian peninsula when it was clasped by hostile sea power, we have some idea of the pounding as between pestle and mortar which went to the making of modern Europe. The pestle was land power from the heartland. I'll just finish there. This extraordinary 10 pages there, which I had to read to you in full. Love this book. Heartily recommend reading it in full. There's so much I could have gone into. This video could have easily been about 4 hours long if I went into each and every chapter, because he's got a great many insights in this book. I thought the most pertinent thing was to talk about Ukraine, which I did at the start, but hopefully that's given you a flavor for what is really a masterpiece in geopolitics. And I'll catch you tomorrow, folks. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.